Hello and welcome back to another edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Any day now, President Cyril Ramaphosa will hold his first real cabinet meeting since the May 29 election. They'll make a few actual decisions and there'll be an actual statement afterwards telling us what happened. What's been happening is a series of set-piece events and Government of National Unity talk shops, and then an ANC-NEC meeting, and then another talk shop between the ANC and its allies, the South African Communist Party, and COSATU, the trades union umbrella. Ramaphosa has tried to use these events to justify going into a government of national unity with the DA as the ANC's biggest partner, while at the same time trying to reassure the ANC faithful that nothing has changed, and then also that the ANC has to change. But the business of governing will soon be back on his shoulders, and we'll see what happens. For now, though, I'm very grateful to have my friend Songezo Zibi on the show. I've been trying to get him ever since May 29th, but he says he's been busy. There was a small matter of absorbing the election results in which his Rise the Mzansi party participated for the first time, and then a period where he was or wasn't going to be in the government of national unity, and then having to move into parliamentary housing in Cape Town, which meant he had to go out and buy bedding and towels all of his own, and then his election as chairman of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, a critical job, and one in which I've no doubt we will be hearing a lot of him. So, Songezo, welcome back and congratulations and everything. By my count, it'll be 80 days almost since the election by the end of this week. And for a country in the sort of economic trouble we're in, that seems an awfully long time for a government to not get going. Or is it just a case of, you know, the longer it takes to start work, the better off we might be?
Peter, good day, and thank you very much for having me on. Yes, it has been a rather strange time of adjustment for me. I thought I would never move house ever since we moved in here in Centurion, but here I was trying to establish myself, even if it's for a few days when I'm in Parliament per week, the 4 days that I'm in Parliament, in Cape Town at the parliamentary village, which has got the aesthetics of an old age home, by the way. But that said, you know, 80 days by South Africa standards, Peter, is a long time. However, I am also aware that this is the first time we don't get a winner, and that in other countries, it can take even longer, like Belgium, the Netherlands. I think it took like forever and so on.
Yeah, Belgium was more than a year.
And in some ways, that very fact exposes exposes some of the work that we have to do, Peter, in order to now cater for the kind of scenarios that we have. In other countries, if there is no government after X number of days, they force a new election, as an example. So it's been an interesting time. 80 days is a long time, but also not under the circumstances.
Yeah. And so, Gizzo, let's also just get the elephant out of the room. Rise Mzansi got less than 1% of the vote. And at one stage, you were expecting more than 5%. You had reasonably good financing and pretty good media. What do you think happened, and what lessons have you learned?
Peter, yeah, a couple of things. And I must say, it took me all of us, it took quite a while for us to process the outcome of the election. So there were two big factors for us, Peter. The first one was MK, because we can actually nearly quantify the votes that we lost from them, because we know where we lost them. So in Gauteng, for instance, We lost to MK largely, about two seats, just in Gauteng alone, as an example. In KZN, we got decimated by MK, because if you recall in some of our earlier conversations, we said we're going for lapsed and disaffected ANC voters. Guess which space MK plays in? It's exactly that same space. And they came like a bullet train and drove a stake right through. So that's one reason. The second reason, Peter, is I think we may have overestimated how long it takes people to trust a political organization. I have been thinking, after looking at the results and where we gained votes and where we didn't, that people placed us in the basket of further consideration rather than voting for us. So they showed up, came to our events, signed up as supporters, but they still didn't know whether they can trust us or not. And we have to prove ourselves in Parliament before they actually latch in and actually vote for us. That said, the diversity geographically and in terms of income and race of our vote is very pleasing. We've had white people voting for us, white South Africans, black South Africans, wealthy, poor, villages, and also in the suburbs. That's something to build on. But we've got a lot of work to do.
But Songezo, just quickly, without dwelling on it too much, where would a voter have become confused between you and between Rise Mzansi and Jacob Zuma's NK party? Your propositions were fundamentally different.
No, Peter, there is something that is unacknowledged in South African politics. It's not just the anger, but it's also the extent to which people also not necessarily driven by our constitutional principles. So let me share some anecdotes with you, Peter. On the campaign trail in Soweto, where we lost significant support, and Action SA, by the way, lost a lot. I mean, they lost about 500,000 votes in this past election. Where in places like Soweto, we campaigning on Vilakazi Street, and I come across two young men, both gay, and they're Zulu. Do you know who they were voting for, Peter? MK. How do you explain that? Right? I was also in Umhlanga, and a similar story. People that you do not expect, that would expect would see right through. There are some signals that MK uses that we would stay away from, like tribal nationalism, black nationalism, notions of backward conservatism and so on, which we stayed away from. And we felt we could address before, because people would ask Peter that, listen, we like you, but if you were to agree to outlaw gay marriage, then I would vote for you. MK came and said, we're going to do it.
Okay, then talk about, Songezo, talk about where we are as a country today politically. I mean, is it a better place? Are we safer? Are we more stable than we were 9 months ago, a year ago? Will the election turn out to have been a good thing?
Peter, that remains to be seen. What I can tell you is that we have at least paused from the destructive path that we're on. We try to find our way onto the right path. And that is the work that we all have to do. And I think it's a great help that there are more people in the room, not just ANC people, making those kind of decisions. And that is one of the reasons we decided to join the GNU. But Peter, we are still deep in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you confident, or how confident are you, that we can get out of the woods? And what will getting out of the woods look like or feel like?
Peter, I think we can get out of the woods, but the next 7 months will determine whether we eventually get out of the woods or we don't. And getting out of the woods means, I think, greater accountability by those that are in government. And I read your column where you spoke about competence. Just getting the very simple stuff done. You and I have spoken about this a few times, that South Africa's biggest problem is not even the big things necessarily. It's that we can't get really simple things done, right? And I think that if we manage out of the diversity of the people that are in cabinet, and I think in various portfolio committees, if the competition can prove to be a good thing, then it would help South Africa a great deal. Because I don't think the DA wants to be outdone by the ANC and vice versa. And I think that's a good thing.
How would you characterize the EFF performance? The votes slipped back. They filled the stadiums. They did everything you would have thought the EFF needed to do. And they didn't get anywhere.
Well, Peter, they somewhat were attacked by the same thing that that dealt with us. And Action SA were dealing with the same thing. So to give you a sense, I mean, Action SA had 6% of the vote in 2021. They ended up with less than 2% this time around, right? The EFF, similarly, I mean, they didn't lose as much, but in absolute numbers, they lost. And also in percentage terms, they lost. And much of that went to MK, Action SA was the same. But I also think the more important number, Peter, is the fact that more and more people stayed away from the polls. I think we have a problem where the political language, the political parties and their culture that we have simply are alienating. And I think the EFF's propensity for violent threats and insulting language and that kind of thing is a turnoff for people. And they are now at the same place where you fight Trumpism, which is your base loves you, but you're never good enough to win the general election.
If the election, knowing what we know, right, about what happened on May 29th, and this is a silly question, but I'd like an answer anyway. If the election were to be held again tomorrow, would the same result apply?
Yeah, I think so. But I think even fewer people would turn up, although the ANC might get higher turnout, because the ANC ecosystem is still traumatized by both the election loss and the coalition with the DA as an anchor to that coalition. And there are lots of people that voted for us, Peter, for Rise, who said if the election was rerun, they wouldn't vote for us, they would vote for the ANC.
Oh, really? No, they thought there'd be a, they thought the ANC would
so,
be...
So that it can get a majority.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And sooner or later, Songezo, surely the partisan, the GNU, are going to run up against a brick wall of some sort. So the DA can't put its hand up, surely, for policies like BEE that are a staple for the ANC. And there are crises looming in other spheres of government, not least, say, foreign affairs. But at the same time, the DA can't really upset the apple cart either. Is it, you know, what's its situation? Is it trapped? Is it, you know, is it, what sort of trouble is the DA in? Its ministers are making good, positive noises. But politically, where do they gain here?
No, Peter, I think... I mean, the DA and the ANC both have opportunities out of the GNU, as we do, as Rise Mzansi and the other political parties. I think the important thing is whether any of the political parties understand the importance of compromise. In other words, that in an arrangement like this, you won't have anyone getting everything they want. And I think that what is important is to have arrangements and outcomes where the worst symptoms of what we've had before are effectively dealt with, even if there are still some challenges in the system. For instance, is it politically viable to do away with BEE? No, it's not. It would cause a very serious problem for everybody, including the DA itself. But are there things to fix, such as the government paying 1.5 to 2 times on the cost of goods and services? Of course. So what happened if you eliminated that problem of the state paying too much for goods and services? If you did, I think the taxpayers would be happy, would have money to put into other things, even if you retain BEE as an instance. So I'm trying to imagine, Peter, a scenario, because I don't have a problem with BEE as a philosophy. I've got a problem with its practice by the ANC. But I'm trying to paint a scenario where the two parties get to an outcome which is tangible and it addresses both both imperatives. That's compromise.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not only in government that the DA seems to be sort of, you know, it's not actually happening yet, but I worry about it. But, you know, the outside of government as well, the DA, for instance, and the Freedom Front Plus are beginning to clash in local government in the Western Cape, with the result that so far, in a couple of municipalities, the Freedom Front Plus are now moving away from sort of coalitions with the DA and beginning to talk to the ANC. And I wonder whether this is just two nationalist parties, one black nationalist, one white nationalist, finding, you know, that they share the same core politics, or is it a DA problem?
It is a DA problem, unfortunately, Peter.
Tell me.
And it is a... You know, Peter, one thing I've learned from... I mean, I read a lot of biographies, political biographies, and there's something that the Americans are really good at, and that is trying to understand why certain things are important to you, why their rivals behave in the way they do, and do so without judgment. Because they're trying to figure out how they would behave in particular situations that are strategically important. I think fundamentally the DA does not have the ability to do that. So let me make an example without, you know, spending too much time. The coalition between the DA and the ANC, because that's what the GNU is, only gains legitimacy and has a chance of surviving if there are more political parties in. What does the DA do? The DA shows a fundamental difficulty with that. Now, if you understood why it's important for the ANC to have, you know, the PAC and give their minister land reform and so on, if you understood that, you wouldn't have a problem with it because it then gives this arrangement a chance of success. But I just don't think they cultivate enough in those kind of considerations. And the Freedom Front Plus has had it. Because it's not just in the Western Cape, it is in Gauteng, where if the DA has a position and nobody agrees with it, then they'll take their ball and leave with it. And political parties are just fed up with that behavior.
Why do you think that is, though? I mean, how could you be so wrong?
The DA is never wrong, Peter. The rest of us are. That really is a problem. Let me give you an example, Peter. I mean, the reason we have this person in the city of Johannesburg as mayor is because after painstaking work by the Freedom Front Plus to bring parties together, the DA said no to the Patriotic Alliance. And so Johannesburg is now crumbling under a mayor who's clearly incapable. You know, would I go into any kind of arrangement willingly with the Patriotic Alliance? Of course not. But sometimes in life, you have to choose the lesser of two evils.
And it's choosing not to choose.
And it's choosing not to choose and therefore making a choice, unfortunately, that is damaging. And Johannesburg shouldn't be in this situation. To be honest with you, the most probably would have been a DA mayor in Johannesburg if they were willing to work with the Patriotic Alliance, right? And the Freedom Front Plus and so on. But they wouldn't.
Yeah. How does that end, Songezo?
Not very well for the residents of Johannesburg, for instance. It doesn't end well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And I think we are in that time, Peter. And I make the example of 1994. You know, if everybody was indignantly self-righteous in 94, there wouldn't have been a miracle.
Yeah.
So Madiba went into cabinet with people that had jailed him and called him names and that kind of thing and, you know, and killed some of his best friends and so on. But there is a time in the life of a country where you've got to make arrangements with people like that. Helen herself became mayor of Cape Town with the support of the PAC and a dodgy fellow called Buddy Chaban. You remember?
Yeah.
He had some political party in Cape Town. And eventually Cape Town became what it is now, right, for a lot of people. But it started somewhere. I don't know when they lost the ability to compromise with people that make you hold your nose.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Ramaphosa's own picks for cabinet, particularly in the ANC. It's hard not to be a little bit impressed now with Josientso Ramakgopa. He's now the electricity minister on his own, electricity and energy. He's cruising in a way now. Obviously, load shedding is done. And a good pick, I would have thought. He's making all the right noises about, you know, the right sort of energy mix, and he now has the IRP in his own hands rather than with Gwede Mantashe. But take Gwede, for instance. How does he carry on, for instance, you know, his war on decarbonization, for instance? I mean, he's got a very powerful portfolio still, arguably the engine of the country. What happens to Gwede nationally and politically?
Oh, Gwede is very happy. He doesn't have the headache, which is to solve the country's energy problems, which are significant, Peter. So he's very happy. I have spoken to him. He's completely unfazed, right? He's got a portfolio that has a lot of potential. I don't think it's going to realize it with him in charge, unfortunately. But at the same time, I think that he is... We have an opportunity with a minister who's younger, who's more urbane, is not set in his ways. Although I have to say also, Peter, Josientso, Minister Josientso hasn't started working this is still the outcome of having the excellent Mteto Nyati as chairman of
ESCOM. Yeah, no doubt.
And somebody who's a turnaround specialist, who's done it in a large industrial listed entity, guiding the management of ESCOM on how to get, you know, how to strategically deal with a large industrial in trouble such as ESCOM is. And I think to that extent, he was an excellent pick. And I think we're seeing the result. The test for this minister is yet to come. He gave a good speech, Peter, but that's all.
Yeah. So he's got to get more renewables into the ground. He's got to increase the transmission network. He also surely has to prevent ESCOM from now crowding out the private sector, because what ESCOM is saying now is that it's going to develop its own renewable capacity on the land that it owns around its own power stations, which, of course, are right on the transmission network. They can get access to electricity transmission for renewables that the private sector can only dream about.
No, sure, but ESCOM also doesn't have the money and doesn't have the balance sheet, Peter. So the real test for a minister like José Joram Hopa is actually whether they're able to bring a private investment strategically in to solve a balance sheet problem, which in a way then gets to solve the regulatory dogma that we have. And when you move from it, because for the transmission lines alone, Peter, we need about 550 billion. ESCOM doesn't have that kind of money. The government doesn't have that kind of money. In dollar terms, Peter, that is about $30 billion. It wouldn't be so difficult to raise that kind of money. But as capital does, it comes with some conditions, and that might unlock some of the regulatory dogma that we see. It was, after all, the Asian crisis, Peter, and the overall debt situation that led to the very liberalization of the South African economy when the ANC took over.
Yeah, yeah. We're just talking about private sector and what it can and can't do. Let's just talk about infrastructure for a moment. There's a clear line being drawn in these early weeks of the new government by the ANC, particularly Parks Tau, the new Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, who wants to amend Regulation 8 of the Pensions Fund Act to give him greater access to infrastructure funding, private sector, in other words, your and my savings. While the DA, I'd expect, and certainly business, are saying, hang on a second, just bring on bankable projects. And I presume by bankable projects, that means projects they can build and make a profit out of, which is not, you know, if you've ever looked at the list of projects under a thing called Infrastructure South Africa, there are about 100 of them. And, you know, I've got to say, not many of them look very bankable. They are schools, student residences possibly, but it's pipelines and roads, none of which are obviously bankable. Where does this argument end up? I mean, do we get the infrastructure done, or are we going to still be arguing about it come the next election?
So, you know, Peter, I will relate and I'll try and find you the date, because I think it would be useful. So when Parks Tau presented the budget vote to the DTI committee, his deputy Zuko Godlimbi spoke. And in the committee are people like Mzwandile Masina and Malusi Gigaba and so on. And the chair had to cut him as he was explaining that the mindset that needs to change, and he didn't say in the ANC, he just said, you know, with some honorable members, is the belief that in order properly to unlock a sort of infrastructure and other capital, it necessarily needs to come from the state or by a kind of the fiat of state regulation. The state should be able to create mechanisms through which a private sector capital can make exactly the same contribution. And I felt that it was, I mean, he articulated it better than I am. What am I trying to tell you, Peter? I'm trying to say there is old thinking in the ANC, and there's one or two people who get it, right? And Zuko is young. He was born in 92. And in a way, I think it kind of reflects, yeah, it reflects the kind of the internal tussling. These kind of things are part of the old thinking in the ANC, that the only way we'll trust private capital is if we decide to dip into it ourselves. Right? Rather than creating conditions where it's attractive to invest in public goods. And the government sets rules that create a fair outcome for everybody.
But can you imagine, I mean, explain to me how you even begin to create a bankable project for a company that builds a public school. I mean, it can't run the school for profit.
No, that's where the ANC misdirects itself again. Peter, yes, my proposal. I mentioned we need about $30-40 billion for transmission lines. We can get all of that from private investment, Peter. But we need to create the conditions. So the thinking that you can use pension funds to build schools is wrong-headed. And it's going to end nowhere, Peter. It's not going to happen. Otherwise, it's going to have real economic cost and cost the government money by way of the cost of debt.
Well, hopefully somebody finds a way through, because it's urgent and it needs to get done. And the list is there. The list is, you know, it's got the Infrastructure South Africa is quite an interesting organization. I mean, you know, its project pipeline is transparent and it's there. You can look it up and it will even tell you at what stage. Some of them exaggerated, but you know, they'll tell you whether they're in the planning or whether they're in construction or whether it's finished or not. It's a very nice website if you just Googled Infrastructure South Africa. But boy, there are a lot of projects and there's a long way to go. So talk about your committee. It's on Gezo Skopa. Very famous committee. It's always been prominent. And there's I think if I'm right, there's never been an ANC chair of the Skopa. What do you think your biggest challenges are going to be? Just explain to us what Skopa does and what you want to do with it.
You know, to simplify for the listeners, Peter, of the podcast, the primary client of the Auditor General is the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. Simple, right? But beyond that, Skopa does other things. It monitors the implementation of some of the recommendations, both of the Auditor General, but also of the committee itself, arising out of the Auditor General's feedback. It cooperates with the Special Investigating Unit to recover assets, to make sure that civil action is taken against individuals and companies that have wasted or stolen public funds, and can also propose legislative changes that would strengthen accountability and governance in the governance system. I'm simplifying, Peter, but yeah. I hope I've put it in layman's terms for people to understand. Yeah.
And what do you want to do with it?
So, Peter, there are three things that I'd like to do with the committee. Obviously, the first one is to get all the committee members to become a team. That's the responsibility of leadership, so that we pull in the same direction. And I have to say that so far, the conversations I've had with many of the committee members are very promising, even from members of the ANC. Everybody seems to understand that this is now a different moment. We have to get serious. So that's the first thing. The second thing, Peter, is to target the most problematic patterns and behaviors, because the Auditor General looks back. So by the time matters come to the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, it's late in a way, because the damage is already done, right? So the reason it's important to target the patterns is you target those behaviors and patterns of governance failures that cost the government the most money, whether it is waste or theft. If we were to do that and work over the 5 years to reduce those, I'd be very happy. So that's the second thing. The third thing is that in this committee, at least while I have anything to do with it, working with the other members, coming to Skopa is not going to be an event. It's going to be a repetitive experience for the most problematic entities. So that people understand that you're on a short leash. If you were here, there was a big problem. We want you back in 6 months.
Yeah.
Rather than seeing you in 4 years' time.
Yeah. And do you have a big stick?
Yes, the stick has just never been used. I mean, SCOPA, for instance, I mean, all parliamentary committees have the same powers. It can subpoena people. But one of the things SCOPA, I think, is able to do, and I'm meeting the legal advisor in a few days' time for Parliament, legal counsel, is that you can also subpoena all reports, correspondence, and minutes, and so on, between officials on a particular matter. So in other words, it's not enough to just bring a beautiful slides. Sometimes you want to see the underlying information, and you must give it on the pain of prosecution.
Yeah. So, Gizzo, just coming towards the end now, looking to the near future, not the middle, not the medium term, near future, the local government elections in 2026, in what way would you expect the result to be different from this year's general election results?
For Rise Mzansi.
Just generally, and for Rise Mzansi.
It's difficult to call, Peter, because turnout in the local government elections is even lower. But one thing I expect is that the ANC will continue to bleed. The question is, where does that support go? Because remember, it is out of experiences at a local level that the ANC got punished this time around. It's its conduct in municipalities, the day-to-day experiences people have under the ANC that caused them to punish the ANC and any party that is incumbent, either by staying away or voting against them. So I think they will continue to bleed unless they do something really drastic. But I don't think there is muscle to change course in the fundamental way they need to.
Yeah. And then Ramaphosa faces an ANC elective conference in 2027. By then, the ANC may have moved him along, but for the moment, he seems quite secure. I don't know whether you share that view. Would he want a third term as party leader? Because obviously he can have a third term as party leader. He just can't have another term as head of state. Or would the party want to stick with tradition and elect somebody who could become president of the country? What do you think is going to happen?
Peter, I must be honest with you. I don't know, because they limited their presidents to two terms.
Yeah.
I don't know if they reversed that.
Oh, have they? Oh, God. Yeah.
They limited their presidents to two terms because of the Thabo Mbeki experience in Kuruma.
Yeah. So does that mean...
So he is going.
Yeah. Okay.
He's going.
And is that inevitable?
The question is whether it's in 2 years' time or 5 years' time.
Yes. And does that inevitably mean President Paul Mashatile, for the ANC at least, if not the country?
He's in pole position.
And it would take a lot to upset that, I presume.
It would. I mean, look, there's also precedent in the ANC in many ways, right? At least, I mean, Cyril himself was deputy president. It doesn't mean, Mashatile wouldn't get contested. But I think that there's more chance than not that he would get elected president.
Yeah. So, Gizzo, I know you're pressed for time, so let me thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and good luck in the months and years ahead. We'll all be watching you as you lean into your new role. And thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with another edition of Podcast from the Edge. And until then, be safe. Bye-bye.